time once again for Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 in London. Time for the most exciting 60 minutes in radio, Stacey.
Well, so are you all like, you know, at the forecourt collecting all your petrol and little jerry cans, getting ready for the strike that never came?
Oh, yeah. Well, the price of petrol, as we've been saying on this show for a while, is continuing to go up. And this is really going to be the story of the next year or two because of what I call debtflation. This is a term that I coined, and it resolves neatly the entire inflation-deflation debate. Stacey?
Oh, Max, well, you are, of course, going to have to explain to us what debtflation is.
Yeah, well, you know, people are saying, is the economy deflating or inflating? They look at the price of petrol and they say it's inflating, but they look at the fact that you've got a collapse in housing prices in various countries around the world, and they're saying, oh, that's deflation. And the central banks talk about deflation. You know, Ben Bernanke and Mervyn King say they fear deflation. The problem is deflation, and that's why they are keeping interest rates low and buying back bonds, is because they fear deflation. And yet, if you look at the prices at the pump, prices are going up. So what's going on here? How come there seems to be this huge disconnect? And this has been a question now for 4 or 5 years, really since the 2007-2008 crisis began, because if you recall, in the aftermath of the Lehman collapse, everyone was calling for inflation and dollar collapse, but dollar went up. And in fact, there was deflation as the various economies started unwinding all of their various bad debt. But now it's clear that what we're experiencing is what I call debtflation. And debtflation is simply the response by the central banks to the shrinking economies around the world of creating more bonds, creating more debt, and creating more debt in excess of any money supply that they're creating. So the money supply is expanding at one rate, but the debt supply is being created at a much faster rate. Now, this is deflationary. This is debt. This is debt, debtflation, debt saturation, debt creation. But what's happening at the same time is that people around the world who have money fear what will happen when you hit debt saturation and the central banks begin to engage in wholesale, out of control debt monetization, that is to say, buying back this debt even at a greater rate than they're already buying back this debt. Because in the United States, 61% of the government debt's being bought by the government as the debt is being monetized. So when that happens, of course, you will get the hyperinflation that you saw, let's say, in places famously like Weimar Republic or Zimbabwe. It's the same thing as a currency collapse. So at the moment, oil, or, you know, more specifically gold and silver, are being bought up in anticipation of an event. You know, markets are a discounting mechanism. You know, price of gold is going up not because gold has even started its bull market yet. It's going up because people are fearful of what happens when this thing blows up and the bull market in gold begins. So the move from 100 pounds to 1,000 pounds, although it looks like a huge move, it's really just a precursor to what will be the big move when gold in dollar terms goes from $1,650 an ounce to $6,000, $7,000 an ounce. That's going to be the real bull market in gold. This is really just a warm-up act. So the debtflation is what we're experiencing now. You have debt is expanding faster than the money supply, which creates central banks' rhetoric of a deflating economy. This will be, at some point, 180-degree polarizing flip will occur quite suddenly. It won't be like the 70s where it crept up over a number of years, it'll be a currency devaluation, and that will be the debt, that will be the currency collapse, and this is what really is the end of the 30-year debt binge.
Well, you know, we are all, the population itself is kind of trained to live off Farmville and all these other virtual realities. And what do you think of the fact that, yes, debt is increasing by 4 times GDP in the U.S., and also last year, 61% of all new Treasury issuance was purchased by the Fed. So there doesn't seem to be yet any sort of backlash at that, that they're buying their own debt, which is, you know, something that was more familiar to a banana republic, for example. So, but there don't seem to be any consequences. People are still sending them goods and services and, you know, accepting that whatever in exchange back, that the dollars they receive back are somehow worth something. So, I mean, how long can that sustain itself? Because it doesn't seem to me that anybody has a problem.
Yeah, it's like a reservoir of debt. So whether it's the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank or the Bank of England, the debt that they carry on their balance sheet, in the case of the U.S., went from roughly $500 billion to well over $3 trillion officially, and then unofficially it's a much bigger number than that. The European Central Bank, as part of the bailout of Greece or the whole Greek collapse crisis, the way they resolved it temporarily is they swapped all of the bad debt onto the books of the European Central Bank, and they've done this with various other countries. So now they're carrying over 3 trillion euros in debt. And so these big debt pools or reservoirs are sitting on the books of these central banks. And to service these debts, it's manageable to some degree because interest rates are near 0%. But even with interest rates at near 0%, you do hit a threshold of when the income, the entire GDP, let's say, or the entire income, the entire tax revenues of a country are less than the debt service cost. And this is happening in places like the U.S. where, let's say, the interest on the debt in America, just to pay the interest, is more than the $3 trillion they collect in tax revenue, for example. As you get to that point, that's the banana republic stage. That's when you can't, there's no case to be made. Even now, Stacey, they're saying that they believe that their policies will create growth and enough growth that to pay back the debt. So this goes unchallenged in the mainstream financial press, and it's considered to be a viable comment. But when the tax revenues are not sufficient to even pay the interest on the debt, then it's clear that there is no remedy other than a currency collapse. That's the remedy, and that's where we're headed. So this is what's going on.
Well, Max, speaking of debt, today in Ireland, 3.1 billion euros is going to be paid to the unsecured creditors of Anglo-Irish Bank. Apparently, the Irish government is going to transfer the funds from NAMA. On the other hand, you have a 100 euro property and household services or water services, something like that, a local tax, a mortgage tax, a property tax that was imposed by the government as part of the austerity measures. Now it's due today, and apparently so far only 30% of the population has paid this tax, leaving 70% who haven't. And the government says that they're going to basically form militias to go get it. They're going to form collection agencies that are going to go knock on the doors of Irish citizens from April 4th, demanding this money.
Yeah, well, this is getting interesting. As of the last count, 70% have chosen not to pay this fee. Because quite rightfully, they they instinctively know that it'll be 100 euros today, and then in a couple of months they'll want 200 euros, and by next year it'll be, you know, higher again. And so this needs to be nipped in the bud, and the Irish people are taking a stand. Also, I think it's interesting, you see, when you talk about the NAMA paying off the Anglo-Irish debt, and of course NAMA is just a huge slush fund and so-called bad bank, and through the
National Asset Management Agency.
Yeah, and this is just was a shell game where bank debts were shuttled back and forth to these new entities, these new accounts. And so when you say a 3 billion euro debt to be paid, people have trouble wrapping their minds around that number. Mm. And it becomes very abstract, and it's hard to talk about. But when you say that we're taking 100 euros from you, this is very real. People can immediately identify with that. They're saying, you know, that's you know, 15 cups of coffee down at my overpriced coffee shop. I can relate to that. That's 100 euros. I know what that means. That's filling up my tank with petrol. That's 100. That's what I have in my pocket. So it becomes very real, and therefore their actions are quite axiomatic, very real. They're like, you know what? I'm not going to pay that 100. If the government came to the people and said, you know, the people already have something like 150,000 euros per head of debt hanging over their head. They don't see it, though. They don't understand it. It's too abstract. If the government came to them and said, we're going to impose a tax where you're all liable for an additional 100,000 euros, and we're going to extract this through taxing, you know, some access road and offset it with a combination of a petrol deferred tax on a proposed realignment of a multiple mortgage re-securitization, people would say, oh, that's horrible. What did you just say? And they would end up paying the tax, and that would be that. But because the government just said, you know what, we're just going to take 100 euros out of your pocket because we're thugs and you're an idiot, people are rightfully saying, you know what, that's it. We're drawing a line in the sand. We're not paying the 100 euros. And I think this was the mistake by government. I think government, see, the way the government thinks about it is that, well, no one can object to something small like 100 euros because the government deals in massive fraud. And the idea of stealing 100 euros to the average person working in government is meaningless. But to the average person, the idea of stealing 100 euros is meaningful. If you stole 100 euros from your fellow Irish person down at the pub, there a fight would break out. If you stole their country, stole their sovereignty, stole their infrastructure, they would mumble something about, this is awful, well, I want my sovereignty back, and keep on drinking. But 100 euros, that's real. So this is a great demonstration of how economics looks completely different depending on who's looking at it. And I believe come next week, when it turns out that 70% of the Irish folks, Irish Republic, did not pay this horrible 100 euro tithing, you know, could be the beginning of a big social movement.
Well, the most important ingredient, the element to this that we left out, was the fact for the primary reason that people are not paying this is that they don't believe the money will go to the local services that the government claims it's going to. They mostly believe that it's going to the bankers. So there's a real, this is a real genuine revolutionary idea and moment where they don't believe in the fact that the government represents them anymore. And we saw that in the 1770s in America. And now we're seeing it in Ireland. They don't believe that the government represents them. And if they, you know, if this is an idea that spreads, that they think anytime their taxes are just going to bankers, it's just a wealth transfer to a handful of guys that were very well connected. And let's remember, Anglo-Irish was not a bank like Northern Rock. It wasn't a, you know, a bank, a high street bank with lots of people with deposits there. It was a bank basically that gave a bunch of commercial loans to a handful of guys. I think there's a golden circle there. It's kind of like in what happened in Iceland. There's like 10 guys that were property developers that they all gave each other billions and billions of dollars and euros in loans, that they went bust when the property market crashed. So they just transferred all those bad debts to the population.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Anglo-Irish debt was engineered. This is a bank that is a pure business-to-business bank that serviced the real estate developing community that went bust because they were mismanaged and made horrible bets. And then the government backed up those bad debts and then have come crawling to the Irish people for €100 donation to help pay for the sins of this bank. And the people who believe that this money is going to go into the banking bailout are, of course, 100% correct. Maybe not 100 cents on the dollar, but definitely 99 cents on the euro are going to go to the banking slush fund. One penny will go to, cocktails or drugs. Or if you work at RTE, of course, you have to buy your cocaine. This is what they do down there last year, a major scandal. So it's a wealth transfer mechanism. It's a blatant wealth transfer mechanism. It's disgusting in a lot of ways. I think it just gets, sticks in the craw of the average person that how it's not even dressed up as some in the language of fakakta, economic financial jargon that you can just kind of pretend to half understand and hope for the best. This is just getting mugged. This is a mugging. People are just had it. Now, will a social movement spring from this next week? A grassroots social movement. It seems to me, observing the population, and we've been to Ireland a few times. We were at the Kilkenomics Festival for several days. I spoke on several panels. I met a lot of people there. I've done my stand-up raid show in Dublin a couple of times. And it seems that whereas a year ago or 2 years ago, the people were thinking that this was a correction in an ongoing bull market. The real estate prices were merely correcting and that they would shortly resume their upward climb. And that the average response was that, yeah, it's tough, but, we had it great for so many years. We give a year back, give 2 years back. We had a great 10 years. Now it seems that people are beginning to realize that the real estate market is not anywhere near bottoming out or coming back or replenishing that wealth that was taken, and that the economy is in not good straits, and that the government is continuing on its push to sell off strategic assets, wealth-producing assets, to outside foreign creditors. So the mood seems to have changed, Stacey. The mood to me seems to be that the Irish people are finally woken up to the fact that if they don't act to save their sovereignty, not just their economic sovereignty, but their political sovereignty as well, that it's all lost.
Well, the thing about it that's revolutionary is that, it's not like in the U.S. in the 60s or something where it's just peace-loving young hippies who were the ones that were going to be, drafted into the Vietnam War. So, of course, they had much more incentive to rise up. Here, it's young people. It's, people who were, say, living on the dole. But it's more importantly, the danger to the government is that it's all the articles that have covered this story in Ireland have talked about and gone out to the very conservative areas of middle-aged and, people nearing retirement, people who were otherwise law-abiding citizens and believed in, the opposite of being a welfare state. They believed in just free markets and things like that. They're the ones that are rising up and rejecting and refusing to pay this €100. And obviously a lot of them can afford it. It's not a matter of not having the money. It's just the principle where they believe, they say, that it will just be transferred to bankers, and they don't believe in that.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing about it, is that once This group, as you've described them, let's say middle-class people who have been playing by the rules, playing by the system their entire lives, once they break the law, which is what they're doing now, it's easy to break the law again. You know, once you make that foray into breaking the law, you know, it becomes a lot easier the next time. And so now they've mobilized a huge group of people that are, you know, they figure, well, I've already broken the law. They already have, you know, on me whatever it is they want to do to me. So I've got nothing to lose at this point. You see, up until the point where you break the law, you're thinking, I've got too much to lose. You know, I could lose everything. I need to just keep my head down and stick and preserve what I have. But once you get angry to the point of saying, you know, taking the step, breaking the law, making yourself vulnerable to the full force of a rogue state operating on behalf of a fascist kleptocracy, you then very easily can do it again and again and again. And this is the way revolutions are started because, you know, this is when people just have nothing to lose. They band together. And the weight of the risk-reward, let's say, starts to change in that it's more rewarding and less risky to band together as outlaws to overthrow the government than to sit in your home, keep the windows shade drawn, and hope it all just goes away.
Well, exactly. And there is a principle in law whereby if the juries continuously refuse to enforce the law because they don't think it's fair, or they're unwilling to enforce the law and find the people guilty. So if 70% of the population is refusing to pay this 100 euros, how does the government enforce that? Because what they're supposed to take them before, you know, they get a trial, right? Before they're sentenced to any sort of prison term. What jury is going to find them guilty if 70% of the population doesn't believe in this fee?
Well, it sets a precedent that the people have spit in the face of the government. And once they do it once, they get a taste for it. And they're like, it's like the Wizard of Oz, you know, they think of the government as a very powerful monolith. And especially in Ireland, where the government has been for many decades, it's been a very tight-knit, close group of folks. And there's a lot of crony capitalism there. And so they have a very strong front. Now, once that's pierced, once the people have a triumph, and this will be a big win for the people, it's going to be a lot easier to build on this momentum. And then, of course, within this context of this will be individuals who will rise as natural leaders of this revolution, and they'll be able to, they'll get some airtime and some publicity, which will allow them to communicate to bigger groups of people. And this will build on the momentum. And, you know, this government, I think, has got to start thinking about what happens when you turn your population into a motivated, organized, fearless mass of disgruntled citizens who have all of the righteousness on their side. There's absolutely no case that the government can make that would justify paying Anglo-Irish debts. There is not one single case. These are unsecured debts that, by definition, mean that whoever made the loan to begin with knew, as stated in the indenture of the loan covenant itself, that there was a chance that they would not get their money. That's what happened. They didn't get their money because the risks that were spelled out in the prospectus were realized. Therefore, there is no obligation to pay this debt whatsoever. It's purely a situation where insiders, cronies, are feathering each other's nests at the expense and hardship of the population, who is now motivated to rise up and jam their foot into the wheels of fascism.
Well, again, this is something to look for going forward, because if, you know, this very one specific 100 euro fee tax is the population in Ireland believes it is illegitimate because they believe it is actually going to bankers. So once people realize, people are starting to see this banking class as spongers, and that the more money you give government, It appears that it goes to two classes, either the military-industrial complex or the finance-industrial complex. All of it is just siphoned off into these two groups. And that's what you saw back in, you know, revolutionary days of America. So we'll see how that goes. Now, Max Kaiser.
Yeah.
What else was happening this week? We had testimony, some more MF Global stuff happening. We had, oh, tell us about this coffin story of yours.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was reading the Financial Times today, and they had a story about bacon-shaped colored coffins, which caught my eye. It turns out that the customized coffin business is a growing business, and it's an extension of this idea of individualization by the consumer. When they're out shopping for stuff, people want customized clothes and individualized cars, and they want their individualized lattes down at Starbucks that, as you know, people order things like tall, grande, mocha, frappa, half-calf, decaf, macho, FOMO, and, you know, just this complete absurd individualization trend has now expanded into coffins. So that people get coffins designed like motorcycles, they get them designed like cell phones. One of the most popular ones is a coffin that looks like bacon. And it's not only, this is where it gets really freaking absurd. It's being promoted by a bacon lobbyist group that uses this as a way to promote bacon. So, you know, I have been keen on observing how absurd the trend toward advertising on everything has been over the years. You know, they've got advertisements in urinals, for example, which you wouldn't think would be a great place to put your advertisement, but it's a huge growth industry. Or, you know, just the fact that advertising, people tattoo the logos of companies on their bodies, on their face. People, for a small fee in America, you get a monthly income if you tattoo a logo on your forehead. Etc.
That gave me an idea for an open casket funeral, is that, you know, the guy's dead, the person's dead, so it's, you know, it's not going to be all that noticeable and permanent, but there is a moment where all the, where everybody goes up there and, you know, views the body. So, maybe they can, could be like a health food store. Maybe they might want to put something on that guy's forehead.
Well, it's a branding opportunity that you're branding the coffin. Now, you start immediately, you think, well, the coffin is going to be 6 feet underground in pitch black, and it doesn't seem like a great place to buy an ad, right? But you combine that with a story from a few weeks ago where there's a service, there's an app, an iPhone app, where that is triggered once you die. And in this, and then, and it triggers a message that appears on your Facebook page that is you talking to people now that you're dead. So just because you're dead doesn't mean that this limits your ability to sell products for people. So imagine if you combine these two now, and you had your bacon shaped coffin and your post you know, life message on Facebook could be brought to you by the same bacon company. Mm-hmm. Who would have an image of you, your bacon coffin. You could be there in your coffin, you could be there and have the funeral. You could even have a webcam with a light placed in the ground showing your coffin for eternity, so that people could say, let's say, I suppose this would work for pets too. So let's say your pet Spot the dog passed away, and you bury Spot the pet into a Kibbles branded coffin, at the pet cemetery, and inside the pet cemetery would be an LED light, and LED lights are good for something like 100 or 200 years before they need to be replaced. And the light shines on your pet's coffin that is giving a branding message for Kibbles and Bits. And they have a web page on Facebook for Spot the dog. And this gets, 50 hits a day for the next 200 years. So you can monetize that on your earnings statement and say we've got 10,000 pets, each getting 50 views a day at their pet coffin that's sponsored by Kibbles and Bits. So death is not a boundary now for advertising to continue selling products. And, of course, the irony here is that bacon itself is probably caused the death to begin with, isn't it? I mean, what's it going to be? Cigarette companies, are going to probably have cigarette package-shaped coffins. So right now they just have pictures of people's rotting skulls and ravaged bodies due to smoking. But that doesn't stop anyone from smoking, especially when if they get enough coupons from the cigarette companies, they can buy their own Lucky Strike-shaped coffin and develop an underground brand-viewing LED light-illuminated perpetual branding opportunity that their heirs can enjoy the revenue for eternity.
Now, also, aside from Ireland, we have stuff going on in across Europe, Spain. Violence fire bombings erupt as Spain announces 27 billion euro deficit cutting plan. Spanish economy will implode. Spain headed for bond revolt and bailouts. This is from Mish Shedlock's site. First he starts with a letter from some guy named Bran who lives in Spain. And he said that the pro-government news played down the strike to a virtual non-event. There's been this big strike going on, giving much criticism of the union methods and exaggerations. Reality, however, is that there is enough support by strikers to shape future politics, especially as austerity starts to bite. The unions have promised to step up protests. The Indignado 15 million movement also protested, but separately from the unions. One comment stuck out. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the protest did not represent Spain. Maybe she was trying to be reassuring, but she is taking sides against maybe a million or so people of a foreign population, not very wise at best and otherwise agitating. She, of course, also has stuck her nose into the French elections because François Hollande is due to win, according to all the polls. I doubt he will, because I'm sure no way the Germans don't want him to win and the Americans don't want him to win. So I'm sure it'll be like a shock 51% win by Nicolas Sarkozy. But right now, and for the last 6 months, all of the polls have shown that that François Hollande will win definitely the second round by a wide margin over Sarkozy. Now, anyway, so, Spain just announced a 27 billion euro deficit cutting plan. It's being called the biggest fiscal adjustment in the country's democratic history, unveiling a 27 billion euro deficit reduction plan that includes sharp spending cuts across government ministries and higher taxes for corporations. With images of nationwide demonstrations and strikes against labor reform still fresh, the weight of the budget appeared to fall on big companies and government spending. Labor unions said that nearly 1 million people took part in the Madrid's rally alone on Thursday evening.
Yeah, well, this is great stuff, really. I mean, because the language says deficit reduction plan, and they talk about the deficit reduction in Greece, and that the deficit reduction plan submitted by the government of Greece with its 20 or 30 or 40 points of compliance that was needed to help reduce the deficit triggered the IMF and the Troika, of which the IMF is a part of, to aid the country in reducing its deficit. And so now one would ask normally, by what percentage was the deficit in Greece reduced after now the dust has settled and everyone, Angela Merkel, got her way and everything is now moving ahead? And the answer would be, well, the deficit has increased. The deficit in Greece was increased. The debt of Greece was increased. They swapped out all of Greece's debt for new debt and more debt that has a longer maturity date and a lower coupon rate, but it's in addition to the debt. Now, this, of course, will require more austerity. And it means that more wealth will be transferred from the bottom 99% to the top 1%. Same thing in Ireland, same thing in America, same thing in the UK, same thing in Spain. So here we see the same language being used, deficit reduction and austerity, which will result in resecuritization of the debt load so that the net amount of debt is increased, which means that they'll need more austerity, which it's just a mechanism to transfer wealth. And Stacy, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't we heading toward a situation where the populations in various countries are all going to be agitated simultaneously? It sounds like more. If you look at the past 1,000 years of Europe, isn't this kind of aren't we reverting to the mean? Isn't this the normal state for Europe? You had the 30-year war, the 100-year war, the Crusades, this war, that war. It's been in a state of war for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, but every one of those wars you mentioned was one of religion. They've always been involved in religious wars.
Well, let me jump in here quickly because we are talking about market fundamentalism, where the markets have become the new religion.
Yeah, and there's a very small fanatical group of disciples and apostles for the bankers, and they control everything, and they're demanding that this is market fundamentalism, transfer your funds to me. Like, I haven't seen it articulated yet in Spain, but it'll be interesting to see if this is the next movement. From, you know, it started with the Arab Spring, moved to Spain, the Spanish Indignado movement, and then it moved to Greece and America, the Occupy movement. Now, Ireland has taken it to the next step with this articulation of the fact that it's a taxation without representation moment. Their taxes are being transferred to an outside body of bankers who they don't know anything about. So let's see if that starts being articulated. Certainly in Spain, they seem to be able to get more people actually out into the streets. It's much more of a visible situation, which in a way is sometimes worse because it's very easy for provocateurs to just create the impression of, anarchy and bad people, and let's bring in the state to restore order at all costs.
All right. Well, the religious wars of the feudal times of the Dark Ages, they're based on the premise of the Roman Catholic Church that people are born into sin, original sin. Replace that with debt. Market fundamentalists are telling the indignados that they were born in debt, that their parents incurred this debt. They were born into debt, and that's why they must submit to the Holy Church of the European Central Bank.
Well, and Angela Merkel, of course, seems like some sort of hair shirt wearing, self-flagellating sort of angry nun.
Yeah, and then you have Brussels is replaced Rome, and then you have someone like Nigel Farage, who is the UKIP MEP, who's become like the new Luther, who's posting his Reformation onto the door of the Vatican. These are the changes we want, but it's all based on market fundamentalism. Brussels is the new Holy See, and original debt is the new propaganda that to replace sin as the cause and reason to transfer all of your wealth to a group of funny walking hat wearing kleptocrats.
I just checked out my Twitter stream, and lots of people are tweeting because they're, as we're recording this Truth About Marcus, people are simultaneously watching the Kaiser report. And somebody said, toads on a plane. Remember we were talking about Ben Bernanke flying the global economic plane, and we're sitting there like toads, the passengers are. So somebody said, toads on a plane.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That could be a good little movie starring Samuel L. Jackson. Hey, so what about this Trayvon guy in America? I read that in the Financial Times they devoted quite a number of inches of ink to this Trayvon scandal.
Oh, yeah, what did they say? Well, it's very bizarre. Andrew Sullivan, who I don't really like, but he does have a site which has lots of good stories. He has a team that gathers lots of good stories. Anyway, he was saying, like, this is the pathetic state of America that has become a totally partisan issue. Apparently, if you're a Republican, you believe that a grown man, a 28-year-old man weighing 240 pounds, 17 stone, is following a teenage boy looking, and you could hear all the 911 calls from this guy. He sounded very agitated. So some agitated looking man following me as a teenager, I can tell you what I would do. I would totally attack that guy if he came anywhere near me. Anyway, all the right wing, the Republican red team, are defending this man, saying the teenage boy who weighed 140 pounds, he was the aggressor. He shouldn't have fought back. When, of course, if it was a white teenage boy being approached and followed and stalked by even a white guy or a Hispanic guy or a black guy, they would say, you know, no white boy should sit there and be raped by a potential pedophile. But so if you're a Republican, you're for this guy murdering a teenage boy and no questions being asked. See, the problem here is an absence of justice. A boy ended up dead, shot in the chest, dead. Usually it should be up to a judge and a jury to decide whether or not a crime has been committed. But the Republicans want to say that we should leave this up to the police. Well, in fact, in this case, the lead detective, the lead homicide detective, that night wrote in a statement that this man, George Zimmerman, who did the shooting, the 17-stone, 240-pound man, he should be charged with manslaughter because the lead homicide detective, who this is his job to investigate homicides, he said he did not believe the shooter's story. However, the Republicans and Fox News are pushing the fact that the state attorney general, she overturned it, right? She said, no, we're not going to prosecute the guy. She's since recused herself from the case, citing a conflict of interest. People want to know what that conflict of interest is. You know, George Zimmerman's father was a judge. He's now retired. But anyway, these are questions that normally would come out in a court of law where the evidence could be examined. But the Republicans are very fanatical. We'll probably have lots of hate mail. You could look at it right now. Go to maxkaiser.com. You're going to see lots of hate mail from people like from Mobile, Alabama. There's this one guy who's obviously very angry that we should even defend a 17-year-old, 140-pound young man for being murdered, shot dead, his life extinguished. Now, a neo-Nazi group, Stormfront, white supremacist group in America, they hacked this young man, Trayvon Martin. He's the one that was murdered. They hacked his email and released all the emails. But basically what they show, and now, any Republican out there, a red team partisan, is going to say he deserved to be murdered because what his emails show is that he spoke to some of his friends and that they were definitely smoking marijuana. So he deserved to be killed. Now, I know half of our audience right now, this second, are looking up in horror, like looking around, panicked, saying, uh-oh, as they're putting down their bong and running and hiding. But in America, that would mean that you deserve to die at the hands of a vigilante, at the hands of a neighborhood watch. But also, what the emails clearly show is here was a young man, an ordinary young man, that he was very worried about his SATs. He was very interested in going to college. He was seeking college applications. This is what most of his emails were about. He was wanting to go to college for university to study aeronautics. And, you know, he wasn't the thug and the loser that the population, the Fox News Rupert Murdoch and his, you know, mindless minions who just watch the show and want any reason to hate. They want to be able to project all their own impotence onto somebody else. And here they found a black young man who deserved to die because whatever reason they want to justify it, because he smoked pot, because he fought back. So George Zimmerman claims. However, we've seen video evidence now from the actual police station that the Republicans want you to believe that this 140-pound young man broke the nose and bashed the head in of this 240-pound man. But the video evidence, there's not a single scratch on this guy. Now, I got into a bus accident when I was like 8 or 9. I was in a school bus that got in an accident, and I got a little tiny cut on my head, tiny, tiny one. And there's still a scar there. It's a raised scar. But it bled all over the place. The head bleeds a lot. Okay, not a single little drop of blood anywhere on this guy. No signs of any bruising, no signs of any red, no signs of any blood. So there you have it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the teenager was walking around his neighborhood.
His father's neighborhood, yep. It was a gated community.
Mm-hmm. And he's on the phone to his girlfriend, and he gets shot in the chest.
Mm-hmm.
He gets taken to the hospital where he's identified as a John Doe.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know who this teenager who got shot in the chest is. They don't check the phone to see who he was calling. His parents file a missing persons report. And there's no investigation subsequently into his murder. And, he's black.
Yeah. And at the scene, the police took a blood test from the victim, from Trayvon Martin, to see if he had any drugs or alcohol. He didn't in his blood system, but they didn't take any from the shooter. The guy sitting on the scene. So we don't know if he was on crystal meth or cocaine, or, you know, he was, you know, all amped up on top of his already natural state of being amped up. But, you know, so this should be decided in a court of law. This sort of information, these sort of charges, these sort of history, like this guy, George Mark Zimmerman, he wanted to be a policeman. He was like desperate to be one. He tried to be a policeman. They rejected him from the police force. So he became private security, and he was fired from that job because they said he was too hostile and too aggressive. So obviously he wanted to shoot somebody. This was a sort of desire. This is what I would say in court anyway, and let the jury decide. But right now, because the normal course of justice has not been moved forward.
But this happened, 5 weeks ago now? And to me, the key point is that there was no investigation.
Yeah.
Okay. A 17-year-old teenage man was shot in the chest and murdered in Florida, and there was just no investigation. So now, would that be true if it were a white person? And the answer is that it would not be true if it were a white person. So the only time, you know, this would make any sense to anyone listening from outside of America, you know, you have to put it into the context of the lynchings that used to go on in the South, 50, 60 years ago. People didn't consider black men having a worth above garbage. And this clearly, they found garbage on the street, a dead black boy. That's not even worth investigating. So is it race? Does it a comment on race? Well, of course it is. America, as we've said on this show many, many times, is deeply divided by race. And this just shows that the race division is still very much alive. I mean, the people on the right wing who are saying that you can't bring race into it are pretending as if mentioning that he's black is in fact racist. If you say, well, he's black, they'll say, oh, you're a racist. Well, the fact is, I mean, if that would be if, out of the context of a country that didn't have such an abhorrent history of lynchings and slavery and burnings and rape, then that might be something to say. But you're talking about America here.
Well, and then finally on this, and because we're having to wrap up the show now, is that, you know, there are the likes, some people like Carl Denninger is saying, where's the outrage for these two British men who were killed by a teenage black boy in Florida? Well, the justice was delivered. Justice, you know, the normal rules of law happened. Two men ended up dead by gunshot in the street of Florida. The police came. They found evidence. They sought witnesses. And they arrested a boy, the teenage boy. Now, he's just been found guilty this past week, and he's been sentenced to two life sentences without the chance of parole. So that was justice that happened. This is, the anger is not about the fact that a crime has happened. It's the fact that there has been no justice. The same thing with MF Global. There's been no justice there. Money was stolen. That shouldn't have been stolen. And where's the investigation? Where's the evidence being collected? Where's the prosecution? Where's the day in court that the victims deserve?
They don't get it because they're black. Blacks don't have rights in America. I mean, the president of the United States, he's black, but he hasn't done anything that hasn't served the interest of the white minority ruling class. So that was a big waste of a vote.
Well, with that, it's time to go. I see there's one person won the 640 million Mega Millions jackpot. Somebody from Maryland. Somebody did comment, I saw that, you know, it just shows you the inflation, the meaningless of money, that a jackpot, random jackpot, can be almost $1 billion.
Well, I was reading today that those who are in the income bracket making less than $18,000 a year or so spend 9% of their disposable income on lottery tickets.
Well, you know the way this always works, though, and I bet you anything, this isn't going to be one of those people who want it. Maryland is going to be, you know, it's probably going to be like a private security contractor who has a huge house, who's been, you know, winning government contracts for the last 10 years, something like that.
Well, it's a big chunk of change. And, you know, lottery, also reading today that more and more states and cities across America are getting into the casino business because mm-hmm. that's the only business that they can seem to get into. So, you know, we're heading toward that Gulag casino model where it's just casinos and prisons. That's it, from coast to coast.
Yeah, they said that in West Virginia, and I think it was Michigan, that 40% of state revenues are from casinos and lotteries.
Yeah, I mean, this shows up in the jobs data as jobs are increasing in the quote-unquote service sector, which I was reading today how they position the service sector as post industrial sector, which is post-farming sector. So the way that industrial sector was positioned as an improvement over farming, that people think that service is actually an improvement over manufacturing. So people think that being a hotel maid is a superior job, or a casino, a garbage collector is superior to being an automobile manufacturer in a manufacturing business that makes stuff that can be exported that would help the economy grow. And so the service economy apparently is praised as a post-manufacturing improvement. But all of these part-time jobs where they don't qualify for any benefits or any medical, it's forced part-time as it's called, in the so-called service industry, where wages are continuing to collapse, even though the number job numbers themselves look one picture, the actual wages are still steadily going down, and you end up with just basically casinos popping up everywhere and prisons.
With that, it's time to go.
Bye, y'all.